Welcome to Making a Meal of It, the podcast for eaters of all appetites who want to reimagine and reinvigorate their relationships with food, food culture, and food systems. I'm David Santo, your host, as well as host to tens of trillions of microbes, just like you. And this episode is about the dynamic, transformative, ancient, and contemporary process that is fermentation. It also gets into feminist theory, the queering of food, and taste in zero gravity. But before we start stirring the fermentation crock, listen to this. That was the sound of zillions of bacteria burping, of resilient food environments being established, and of trendiness. It was my interpretation, anyway, of how we might sonically represent invisibility, or better, micro-visibility, and of a relationship as old as time. If you go back and listen again, it might also be the sound of sustainable and just food futures, or maybe not. Fermentation is a marvelous thing. A transformation process that preserves food without synthetic chemicals, and that also changes and creates tastes in ways that seem, well, dare I say it, almost magical. Generally speaking, I don't much like using food language that evokes the supernatural or the romantic. Words like passion and love and magic are, to me, kind of overly simplistic ways of talking about why food sometimes transcends our expectations. For the most part, I try to find other terms that express that transcendence using somewhat less juicy terms like attention and care and intentionality. But sometimes a food-related idea or activity is just so remarkably interesting that it's hard to find a good adjective to describe it. So for now, maybe it's okay to say that fermentation is kind of magical. And magical with a CK, that is, just to make it a little more witchy. People have been fermenting food for a very long time. It's a process in which microbes like bacteria and yeasts convert food molecules like sugar into alcohol and acids and gases. Beer and wine are products of fermentation, as are pickles and kefir and yogurt and chocolate, many, many kinds of bread and cheese, salami, soy sauce, vinegar, the list goes on. Wikipedia has a really great page of all sorts of fermented foods from around the world, and the range of things that we ferment is just incredible. And it's not just we humans who ferment. Animals do it too, as you will hear in my second conversation, and also in the Stick This in Your Mouth segment. With the advent of the Industrial Revolution, though, and all that it implicated for food, fermenting became, in part, replaced by more technological forms of food preservation, at least in industrialized nations. Freeze-drying and pasteurization, the addition of chemical stabilizers, acidulation, that is the adding of acids to different prepared foods, and also packaging innovations all became very effective, though very intensive and often damaging, ways of keeping food shelf-stable. Above all, these industrial techniques make food very commercializable. That's the whole point of making things shelf-stable. But over the last 20 years or so, a new wave of visibility and popularity has brought home fermenting back to the fore. Leading lights like author and pro-fermenter Sandor Katz have inspired generations to start pickling and preserving and experimenting with the process, and new lab-based research is focusing on creating novel foods through fermentation, ones that might eventually replace animal flesh or support our immune systems better or just offer delightful new taste experiences. At the same time, fermenting experts urge caution, as you'll hear in this episode. Fermenting is increasingly being hailed as a new savior for planetary biodiversity or as a tool to end food insecurity. But, as we know very well, the complexities of our food systems are much too integrated and interrelated for one thing, one practice, one tool to be the solution for everything. Instead, fermenting might be best when thought about as a way to be more intentional and more caring about your food, given that it's a process that demands a lot more attention than just popping a ready meal in the microwave. The two conversations in today's episode are with a couple of folks who straddle the arts and sciences, the worlds of philosophy and cooking, food studies, and social change. Both are experts in fermentation, and both in many ways defy singular definition, much like fermentation does itself. I think you'll find what they have to say quite thought-provoking, not to mention appetite-provoking. And then later, Maxime and I ponder whether fermentation is a taste unto itself during Stick This in Your Mouth. And closing things off, we hear from a rather delicious filmmaker during the food questionnaire. Kicking things off is Dr. Joshua Evans. Josh is a senior researcher at the Novo Nordisk Foundation Center for Biodiversity at the Technical University of Denmark in Copenhagen. It's there he founded and leads the Sustainable Food Innovation Group. Their work brings together culinary research and development with academic research and practice in the humanities, social sciences, and natural sciences. So Josh, thank you so much for being part of this conversation and joining me on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. It's super nice to see you also again.
It's good to be in contact after all these years. So tell me, let's dive right into it. Tell me what you're doing right now at the Danish Technical University. How did you end up being there?
I'm leading a research group called Sustainable Food Innovation, and we use culinary research and development to make sustainable foods with a big focus on flavor, natural science to study how they work, and social sciences to explore how they can contribute to food culture. We work a lot with fermentation and upcycling of byproducts, so things that a lot of people are working with these days in the sort of culinary innovation space. But I think in particular, what I'm really interested in with all of this culinary work and transdisciplinary research is to use this culinary approach to food innovation to try to enrich food traditions rather than replace them. So often tradition and innovation are kind of pitted against each other, I think, as if it's sort of like a zero-sum game and you have to choose one. But I don't think it has to be that way. I think that's kind of wrong, actually. And so really, you know, if we understand them as two parts of the same system that need each other and actually only make sense in relation to each other, then we can understand how innovation practices can help us continue to make food traditions relevant and alive and sort of further diversifying. But maybe I'm going off on a tangent now, actually.
Well, no, but that's interesting because it's, you know, there's, as we talk about things like, you know, replacing meats with plant-based blah, blah, blahs or, you know, whatever, there's, you know, there's very often a binary that's gets set up. It's either meat grown in the industrial system or alternative proteins grown off of the bodies of animals. And it doesn't have to, both of those are obviously possibilities that can coexist. But you mentioned sustainability. And so if you could just sort of, because sustainability is a big word, it encompasses a lot of stuff. What are the kind of the channels or the axes of sustainability that you're particularly focused on?
A big part of our work is the connection between sustainability and flavor and pleasure. I think pleasure and deliciousness can often be treated as a kind of afterthought or luxury, like a nice to have, but not essential. And I think that's also very wrong. It's actually very crucial. You know, it's a key for food acceptance and therefore also for the green transition. You know, a food can be the most sustainable on paper by all metrics. But if people don't actually want to eat it and aren't enticed by it, then it kind of doesn't matter, right?
Right.
And so that's like a big part of our approach. And then when it comes to sort of the specific things we do and make, a lot of the work is based on novel fermentations. For example, working with things like novel misos or indeed some certain kinds of plant cheese. Also, what's interesting about a lot of them is that this kind of culinary R&D approach not only yields new products, but also from a scientific point of view, yields things that are like scientifically groundbreaking. So for example, with a lot of the novel misos that we make and that I've been working on since my PhD or even before that in Nordic Food Lab, they're not just making new flavors, but they're also opening up new niches, ecological niches that actually allow us to ask scientific questions that maybe we wouldn't have been able to ask before.
So this is why your incredibly transdisciplinary team is so useful and necessary, because you're asking and answering lots of different questions across lots of different disciplines, but also like lots of major questions about the world, including things like sustainability, taste, pleasure, but then, as you said, niches, weird new lives that come into being through fermentation or other practices.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, at least when it works and on good days, I like to think that it's possible to do both. I'm very much like a both and have your cake and eat it too kind of person, I guess, in general.
So you were at the Nordic Food Lab how many years ago?
Oh, gosh, in my youth. I think I was there from 2012 to 2016 for a solid 4 years, yeah.
And then it was from there that you went off and started your PhD at Oxford, is that right?
Yeah, so I went to England and actually went to Cambridge first to do a master's, and I did a 1 year master's there, and then started my PhD at Oxford the next year.
And your PhD at Oxford was largely focused on fermentation, correct?
Yes, it was.
So that kind of blows my mind. I mean, I know universities are, you know, changing over time, but the idea of such a staunch old institution of Oxford having a PhD student doing it, working on fermentation, seems a bit mind blowing. But I wasn't there. So what was that like? What was it like to be doing this kind of work in that kind of institution?
I see what you mean. And I often felt that way too. I mean, I guess I went there mainly to work with my supervisor specifically.
Okay.
I wanted to work with him because he works on human microbe relations and environmental geography and has a very broad perspective. The institution generally, and also my department, I was in the School of Geography. You know, most people in that department are working on things like geomorphology and hydrology and conservation and lots of fascinating, important things. But then for me to be saying, yeah, and I'm working on like novel fermentation practices in rarefied restaurants in Copenhagen, and people are like humoring me, I guess, and maybe didn't quite get it. You know, it really grew out of, in that sense, the work I was doing at Nordic Food Lab and trying to build on at Nordic Food Lab, where the chefs that I was working with there were developing this approach to fermentation, which now is quite common in around the world in many places, of trying to bring traditions from different places together with local and regional raw materials, birthing something both new and old out of that. One way that we could think about this is that we could call it like a translated approach to fermentation. So in the same way that we might translate a book from one language into another, we can maybe do the same with recipes, or more specifically with fermentation processes, right? Like making a miso, but instead of using soybeans and rice koji, which would be very traditional in Japan, using yellow peas and barley koji in Denmark. And the flavor that you get, it's a miso on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's very much not a Japanese taste. It's sort of, for Danes at least, it's a very nostalgic taste of something that your grandma might cook you. And so these chefs were developing this approach with, you know, dozens, hundreds of different examples of this kind of thing for flavor. Their goal was like, we want to make new flavors that we can give to the restaurant or publish openly. At Nordic Food Lab, we shared everything open source. But what I became really interested in was also learning a bit more about the microbiology alongside doing the fermentations. You know, based on how quickly we know these microbes reproduce, how promiscuously they share their genetic information with each other, how rapidly they adapt to new environments, it was very likely that these very flavor-oriented experiments might be having much larger effects than simply creating, you know, beautiful new flavors, which of course is also a contribution. Without realizing it or even trying to, these chefs might be bringing new forms of life into the world. Now, especially since my PhD in my new research group, now that I actually have, you know, resources and people who are experts, now that I have proper scientists to like go into all of this, we're finding some super fascinating findings around like novel biodiversity, novel microbial ecologies and evolution, all because of this drive for new flavors.
What is it that you're, because I remember back at the Nordic Food Lab, you were also working on some things like garums or soy sauces that were made out of fermenting grasshoppers or crickets. Right. There was some insect life that was going into those things, a bit like the fish that would have gone into old garum recipes. Mm-hmm. But what kinds of things are you putting together in the edible sphere right now in your new work?
Like a lot of our culinary work is being driven by my group's R&D chef, Kim Weyendorp. And Kim's a chef. He's a proper chef, rather than me, who's like a pretend person who's not trained in that. You know, he's been working in the industry for a couple of decades. He's traveled around a lot. He worked at this restaurant in Copenhagen called Amass for many years, leading all of their R&D. And he's sort of become a kind of expert in culinary upcycling and works a lot with fermentation. And some of the stuff that I'm really excited that he's making are like working a lot with like local farms, for example, and using this approach of culinary upcycling to create new things that then we can give that knowledge back to them and say, hey, you can also use this to make a new product. For example, he's used the root of the endive plant, which sounds very sort of like uncommon, but surprisingly is very voluminous in the EU. I mean, there's like 600,000 tons of this root produced every year, but only the green part, which is only 40% of the plant, is used as the vegetable. And the rest, which is the majority of the plant, is just not used. And it's very bitter, but he's made a tonic out of it. So grating the roots and making a wild fermentation out of it. And then he found that it gets very citrusy aromas and sort of turned that into a novel tonic water. It's sort of bizarre, but very beautiful. Another thing I really love that he makes is this amino sauce. So kind of like a soy sauce analog, but made from the spent myceliums from mushroom farming.
Wow.
Which themselves have been grown on coffee grounds. So this is really fun because it's like a double upcycled product, right? First, the mushroom farmers have grown the mushrooms on spent coffee grounds. The mushroom mycelia have broken down a lot of the proteins in the coffee grounds into amino acids already. And then when you mix those into brine and with some koji and let it ferment, then you get this super umami, sort of coffee-y, mushroomy soy sauce.
Wow.
From something that has already been upcycled. And I find that very compelling.
My mind is like, I want some. Are these products that you're, this is all research work. None of these are commercialized at this point.
Yeah. I mean, most of kind of also drawing on the open source approach of Nordic Food Lab, I believe in that quite strongly. You know, so much of this kind of knowledge for the most part is usually produced privately or not shared openly, but we have a big focus in my group on sharing everything openly. So most of the work that we do is we just publish it and we share it. We're making a website right now, which will be up in a few weeks or a few months, hopefully, and also publishing in scientific papers. We're also exploring maybe for certain things, partnering with specific commercial partners to like produce things at really bigger scales, because that's where you really start to have transformation happening. But again, I see there's potential in having a both and approach. So often it's this debate of like, do you want to stay small scale and sort of culturally influential, but not have a big reach, like sort of materially? Or do you want to scale up and reach a lot of people and have quote unquote impact, but maybe at the expense of like being super rarefied or frontier groundbreaking or whatever? And I'm like, well, surely we can have both of those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and fermenting has become, you know, not just since COVID, but over the last 10, 15 years, fermenting has become a very popular home-based practice. Again, of course, it always was popular. Fermentation has been around for millennia as a food preservation technique, as a food transformation technique, because it is relatively easy to do. You have to be attentive. You have to take care of your ferments. You have to watch them. You have to, you know, they're your babies. But more and more people are doing that. And so if you're sharing those recipes that you're developing in a more R&D type way with the larger global fermentation community, it must be pretty exciting for people to have access to that content. That's you know, that's the stuff that we can't necessarily do on our own, but we can benefit from in our homes. So one last question for you on the extremes, the limits, the dramatic worlds that you have occupied. I have read somewhere that some of your miso has actually ended up on the International Space Station. Is that true? Have you made space miso? What's that about?
It's true. I'm guilty. It is true.
You snuck it on.
It's some days it actually felt that way. This was this project with my collaborator, Maggie Koblenz at MIT Media Lab. They have a space exploration initiative there. And it emerged because Maggie had a slot on the ISS for an experiment and wanted to do something with food. And we sort of got connected. And at that moment, I was in the thick of my PhD thinking a lot about miso ecology. And I thought, well, it could be pretty feasible to send a little pot of miso to the ISS to see if it would ferment differently there compared to Earth. Is there something
like in microgravity, basically?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the main factors that might change it would be that, and also very much cosmic radiation. There's more exposure to cosmic radiation there because it's outside of the Earth's atmosphere. And so, you know, we were really interested in exploring this question. Is there a kind of space terroir, if you will? and this might be a really tractable way to measure that. And that really, that would connect very well to the questions I was already asking in my PhD of, does the pursuit of flavor somehow shape microbial ecology differently? So there's the kind of basic science question there. There was also a set of applied science questions around the potential of fermentation to enhance astronaut nutrition and flavor experience, especially on like long missions, for example, to Mars. And we also know, I mean, for anyone who's tried to eat on an airplane, you know that the senses do weird things. And this is even more true in microgravity, very commonly reported by astronauts that on space flights, they often have very depressed senses of taste, or it gets really wonky. And something they crave a lot are like really salty, pungent spicy things, for example. And so we were again like, well, maybe miso and figuring out if we can actually ferment in space in general can actually open up a really important new, more applied research area on if fermentation is possible in space, maybe astronauts can actually get access to foods that they crave in a way that is like more practicable.
So what happened to the miso?
So yeah, the short answer is you can ferment in space. It turns out. This was for anyone who's been wondering. So I think we had this sort of dual finding. You know, the first one is, first and foremost, it was a miso that we got. You know, it fermented more or less how we would expect it to ferment on Earth, in the sense that it yielded a product that is safe, that is umami, that does all the things that you want a miso to do. However, beyond that, we also noticed some really interesting differences in the space miso compared to the Earth, both in the microbial ecology, in the flavor chemistry, and also doing some sensory analysis. And that's a paper that we're almost finished, hopefully going to submit it in the next like week or two. I'm really excited for that one to come out, because that project has been a very long, arduous process. It requires so very much red tape to send even the tiniest part of it to the ISS.
Yeah.
Hopefully it was worth it.
Well, we'll see. I love the idea of space terroir. I mean, I hate the idea of space terroir, but it's a very interesting. The taste of place becomes the taste of space, or, you know, atmosphere or something like that. I don't know. There's a whole lot of neologisms that I don't want to get into.
Yeah.
I thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure talking to you, Josh, and such an eye-opening experience of knowledge creation in multiple different directions and multiple generalist, specialist, and connection-making ways. Thank you so much, and happy fermenting.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And to see more about what Josh is up to, take a look at his personal website, joshuadavidevans.com. And to read more about his space miso, check out the show notes for a link to a February 2024 article in New Scientist. Next up is my conversation with Dr. Maya Hay, a postdoctoral researcher with the Center for the Social Study of Microbes at the University of Helsinki. Maya's background in dance, nutrition, gastronomy, feminism, and communications all come together to provide great cross-disciplinary perspectives on food, human, and microbial relations. Maya and I first knew each other, like quite a few of this podcast's guests, at the University of Gastronomic Sciences in Italy, and it was in her apartment in Polenzo, Italy, that I first learned to make kimchi.
So Maya, thank you very much for sitting down and chatting with me about things fermentable and things fermented and things fermenting.
Thank you for having me.
I mean, you and I have been talking about fermented things for a very long time.
Indeed.
And you've taken a significant path since those days back at the University of Gastronomic Sciences.
Mm-hmm.
Remind me, how did fermentation come to be such a focus of your work?
Yeah. So my background is in nutrition
and
health sciences. And I got really disillusioned with the prescriptive model of eat this, not that, this many grams, this many calories. And by focusing on the grams and calories, it was never about the food. It was always about this abstracted idea, this very reductionist understanding of
the science of calories and grams and all that stuff.
Exactly. And I just wanted to focus more, not just on the food, but also the bodies and the bodies in the greater context, whatever that context was.
So not just human bodies.
Also. So one of the ways that I came to fermentation was, well, if I'm asking the question of who am I to tell you what to eat? And if I wanted to get away from that prescriptive, you know, finger wagging model, what is the one thing that can cut across different food cultures, across histories that wasn't prescriptive? And that's how I arrived at fermentation, because fermentation, you have to figure it out yourself. And if you look at any quote recipe of ferments, it's usually a novel. It's an essay. It asks you to troubleshoot all of these different ways. It's never just combine, stir, and bake, right? You really have to figure your way out through it. And that gave me so much hope for maybe this is the way for people to have a better understanding of not just the food that they make, but where it comes from, what organisms were a part of it, what environments were part of it, and what historical, social, and cultural contexts made that ferment happen. So that was the whole inspiration for this is the world I want to be occupying. And then we can also talk about, right, the microbes and how that invisible, quote unquote, invisible world challenges us.
It's fermentation, like as we know it, when you make pickles or when you make beer, or when you make other stuff that mm-hmm. involves yeast or bacteria. Mm-hmm. But it's also fermentation in a super social sense.
Yeah, it's also about people. It's also about knowledge. It's also about, you know, changing the way, the attitudes and the ethos, mm-hmm. right, of a place. Mm-hmm.
So what are you working on right now?
So now I'm trying to expand the idea of how do we come to know microbes? It's a very epistemological question, which is a mouthful, epistemologies, right?
The theory of knowledge.
How we come to know the thing,
yeah.
right? And I'm interested in non-scientific, non-visual ways of coming to understand microbes. Mm. Science has understood microbes in very particular ways. Petri plates, gene sequencing, cell culturing, right? There's all sorts of ways to understand microbes in that particular setting, laboratory settings or right. people with training. And I want to expand that to be like, well, fermenters have known microbes prior to the idea of a microbe existing, but also people who have composted, who have gardened. There are so many other ways of knowing microbes that are also beyond the visual, mm-hmm. right? So how can we tap into our other senses, our sense of smell, our sense of sound, and our sense of touch, our sense of orientation in space? Mm. All of these are ways that we come to know the world around us.
Right.
And so I want to both develop better methods for understanding that, but also expand the question of who can know what a microbe is.
Right. So, I mean, in many ways, what your original motivation to get away from the scientized version of nutrition,
yeah.
you're also trying to get away from the purely scientized version of microbes and fermenting.
Absolutely. And I think that there's room even to work with scientists on this, right? So it's not an antagonism of, well, you science people don't understand, but more you have a very particular and partial way of mm-hmm. understanding mm-hmm. microbes and this knowledge. Well, here are other ways of complementing that, and how can we hybridize these knowledge?
So it's a lot like what we talk about when we talk about food systems, the whole package of all the ways of knowing, mm-hmm. in this case, food or microbes or fermentation, trying to get to a more holistic and pluralistic sense of how
yes.
this thing exists in the world and what it does for us and with us. Because that's another thing that you spend time on, is this yeah. idea that during fermentation, you're actually in collaboration with another species. Who's in charge is the great question.
Yeah.
Who's in charge when it comes to fermenting, Maya?
Yeah, it is such a great thought experiment, right? Because it's not just another species. It's a lot of different species, right? I'm inspired by your work even, right? How you said food is lively, complex, mm-hmm. and intersubjective. Mm-hmm. And I have been saying, well, microbes are everywhere, invisible, and necessary for right. our lives to thrive. We really have to tap into and attune to this whole other register of being.
Yeah.
And that is the work of, like, a sign of a good fermenter is being able to know and compile all of this information. What is in the surroundings? What is happening? What is attuning to the body? What does the body say?
Suddenly we're realizing, I think at a much more visceral level, humans are starting to understand, no, we are not in charge of this planet.
Yeah.
And a lot of other things are there that we need to collaborate with, or that we need to be in relationship with rather than trying to dominate in some way. That's very practical when it comes to flu and COVID viruses, but it's also really important in terms of extending that relationality out mm-hmm. beyond the micro and into the macro world. As well. Mm-hmm. And is that also part of why it's interesting to work with microbes, because they're yeah. also a teaching object for dealing with other humans?
It is a very good heuristic for understanding that humans are living in a microbial world mm-hmm. as opposed to microbes that happen to be and disrupting a very human world. And in that sense, this, you know, microbes allow for us to challenge a very human-centered way of thinking, but also human-centered policy even. And so fermentation is a very direct, hands-on method for not just in the abstract thinking about what the microbe is doing. Mm. It's a very tactile engagement. It's a very visceral process of trying to figure out this world that we cannot easily see or detect.
You're known as a leading thinker in academic circles when it comes to connecting food, fermentation, and feminism, the three Fs.
Yes.
But could you explain how fermentation and feminism are connected, either practically or theoretically?
Sure. I have two answers to this question.
Excellent.
And the first one is a bit more philosophical. And mm-hmm. here I'm guided by a lot of feminist thinkers who are grappling with science and questions that scientists take up. So a lot of feminist science thinkers are questioning, well, what is objective truth versus subjective truth? And how do we come to know the things that we know, whether that is through the mind and reasoning or through an embodied sense? And what a lot of these feminist accounts are trying to point at are saying, you know, this binary of mind and body or good and evil or objective, subjective, none of that's really working for us. And maybe the whole premise of separating those two as extreme polar opposites is maybe not the way to go. Mm-hmm. And so I'm led by a lot of these feminist thinkers who are really questioning the science behind microbiology, not microbiology per se, but about the very scientific world, science as a culture and a way of thinking, a frame of thinking. So that's one realm where fermentation allows me to philosophically engage with feminist thinkers like Lisa Heldke.
Yes, right? Who was on the podcast Fantastic. Earlier in the series. Yeah, and, yes. and she was talking about exactly the same thing, the sort of the mind-body duality, yeah. the problems with Cartesianism,
yep.
the whole issue of separating object and subject. And yeah. so this, what you're saying is it's fermentation is sort of an extension of that it incredible is. Work that she's been doing all this time.
It is. And one of my perhaps most quotable Lisa Heldke book chapter is food making as a thoughtful practice, mm-hmm. right? How do you know when the bread is done baking? You can either stick a thermometer in it, or my nose knows when the bread is done and my ears know if I tap the underside,
yeah, yeah.
right? That there is a very embodied way of knowing. And I have extended that to this whole other microbial realm, that undercurrent that you were mentioning earlier. So that's answer number one, the philosophical. On a more practical level, the grounded understanding that I have with feminism is the question of who can know, who can do fermentation, mm-hmm. for whom is fermentation? And now we start to ask the questions of not just gender, of who can know and who can ferment and who can be assigned, you know, a good fermenter, but also the expanding the very intersectional understanding of human differences to also understand what kinds of things result. So for instance, not just the gendered aspect of people's bodies, but also class, race, able-bodiedness. And we can look to examples like how ferments in the Western European context can often look to the exoticized East Asian ferments, right? We can look at koji and how it's been sort of taken up kimchi. But we can also look at class too, and the sort of affluence speaking for someone's expertise.
So if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that fermentation is also a way to sort of re-theorize all sorts of human relationships, all sorts of relationships that we have with other people, whether they're people of our own socioeconomic intersectional group, or if there are people of different ethnic or body abilities, or people of different gender presentations or sexualities. Like, if this is a way of starting to rethink human-human relationships as you're rethinking human microbial relationships. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. And I'm also looking at human environment relationships mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
And so that these are where the relationships really matter. And yeah. so some of the critiques that I have towards fermenters of today are that it's a very extractivist mm-hmm. mindset, whether it's I'm going to extract and bioprospect this particular strain from this obscure place and then bring it back to wherever they're going to make a gajillion bucks on. That is just as bad as I'm going to go to this obscure place, learn how to make this ferment and come back and open a restaurant and then make a gajillion bucks off of that. To me, that completely betrays that political, ethical question of how do we relate to one another and how do we continue to relate with one another. And this is maybe the last point that I'll say about, you know, how I came to fermentation. This is now going back to yeah. your first question.
It always starts there.
This idea of how do we keep doing this? Because fermentation had its revival moment, and some people argue that it still is in its revival moment. But prior to this revival, at least in the North American sense, it has been a process for mm-hmm. millennia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's increasing evidence that shows we are not the only species who have been fermenting.
Ah.
Right? So
who else or what else?
Mustelids.
What are those?
Mustelids are a family of badgers and ferrets and weasels that will take whatever nuts and dried berries, they'll bury them and they'll ferment them and come back to it later.
Wow.
Isn't that mind-blowing?
It is mind-blowing, and yet it isn't. Fermentation is such, like, it's a transformative process that is a collaboration between nature and bodies that have more intentional desires. I mean, nature, whatever that means. But so it is surprising, but it's also not surprising in
it
some
isn't,
way.
Right. Yeah. So here we have a process, a transformational process that not only humans, but many organisms have been practicing for millennia. And we're just seeing right now the revival in the last 20 years of it compared to the 2000 before it.
Right.
So
everything old is new again.
Everything old
like
is new
that.
Again. And I think especially at a time when everything feels like it's falling apart, this is a very tangible way of getting at, well, what do we do now in preparation for an unknown future?
Right.
It's not about hype per se. There can be hype, and there's, I think, problems and around that sort of hype around fermentation is going to solve everything.
Right.
We can look to precision fermentation for that, for instance. But I think that there is a very sobering reminder that fermentation has and always will be a question of how do we survive?
Mm.
How do we make it past winter?
Mm-hmm.
How do we make it through the unknown? What do we do now? And that is a very political question.
Yeah. Wow. All right, well, turning to the extractive part of this interview, but just on the maybe the lighter side of things, what are your favorite ferments? What do you like to eat? That do you because you ferment for your own kitchen,
I do.
Right?
My favorite things to eat and my favorite things to ferment are the ones that I can continue doing because I can list the UN of ferments, right? The kimchis, the breads, the yogurts. And, you know, I love natto. I'm not going to make it at a home scale. And so as much as I love the taste of it, and, you know, it has all sorts of memories within me. It's not necessarily a practice that I can sustain.
Right.
And for me, my focus on fermentation has always been the process, less so the product or the outcome of it. And so my favorite ferments are the ones that I know I can persist in and continue.
So how many things are fermenting in your kitchen right now?
At the moment, since I'm away, there's only one that I have entrusted to my partner.
Okay. Because you have to be in a relationship with a fermenting thing because you have to pay attention to it.
But I do have anywhere from 5 to 7 different things going, whether that's kefirs or breads or pickles. It really is. I describe it. I'm working on a book right now and I'm describing it as the practice of spinning multiple plates at different speeds.
Mm-hmm.
Because a sourdough starter, you have to refresh, you know, once or twice a day, right? And that's a very different hands-on temporality than, let's say, you know, pickles where you set it once and you kind of forget it until it's ready to be eaten and that it changes. Ferments change over time,
yeah.
Right? In that sense, I also say that I am a very lazy fermenter. I am very, eyeballing it. Yeah, sure. That's enough.
Well, but that's, I mean, one way of describing it is lazy or unscientific, but the other way of describing it is embodied and present and
correct.
Using all your senses.
Correct. Yeah, my favorite ferments are the ones that I can continue to practice and continue to engage in.
Well, thank you for giving us a remarkably informed, polydimensional, and complex interpretation of fermentation. I really appreciate it. I will circle back to you because I want to hear about the book.
Yeah.
And you'll be telling us about that.
Yes.
And when there's news to share, it will be shared. And happy fermenting.
Thank you so much for having me.
Don't forget, check out the show notes. There we will find Maya's personal website and also a link to the Food Feminism Fermentation website, which contains a collection of documents and texts about some of the ideas she talked about during our conversation.
Hi, Maxim.
Hi, David.
Are you ready to stick this in your mouth?
Really depends what it is.
Well, on this rainy and cold day, we're going to warm things up with some ferments.
Oh, what is ferment?
Well, yeah, they're fermented foods. But what comes to mind when I say fermentation?
The only thing I know about fermentation is two products. It's kimchi and kombucha.
Kimchi.
Yes.
And Trixie Mattel. Oh, no, she's not fermented. She's just salty. No, that's cracker. Anyway, to all the Drag Race friends out there, this is for you. We're going to talk about fermented foods. We're going to taste some fermented foods. Do you think you like fermented foods?
In small quantities.
Okay. Do you know that there are an awful lot of fermented foods that we don't know are fermented?
Oh, tell me about that.
Well, things like saucisson sec, salami.
chocolate is a product of fermentation.
I did not know that.
Yes. And of course, kimchi and miso and soy sauce and fish sauce and some cheeses and yogurt and all sorts of things, because it's a really, really, really practical preservation technique.
Hmm. Well, isn't that special?
And so before refrigeration and before chemical stabilizers, fermentation was an incredibly important way to keep the harvest good to eat until long into the winter season. So things like kimchi are very much about preserving the various fresh vegetables that would be harvested in October and November in Korea and then preserved through fermentation and then be good to eat shortly thereafter, but then stay good throughout the winter so you could have fresh vitamins basically in your body without having to rely on vitamin capsules or food preserved in a different way.
Thank you for this very exhaustive explanation.
Exhaustive and exhausting. Anyway, we're going to try three fermented things. We've got kimchi, we've got miso, and we've got some parga, which is, as I've learned, the term for bee bread. And this is from a Finnish honey producer that actually was brought to me by Maya Hay, who's on this episode.
Hey, so, Maya.
Hey, Maya. And bee bread is pollen that the bees collect and then stuff into their little capsules in their beehives, and it ferments. And it's supposed to be full of nutritional value. It's full of proteins and amino acids and things like this. And there is debate about whether it has other longer-term health benefits.
Well, we'll see if that tastes good or not.
Yes. Well, in this case, they're little nodules in the shape of hexagons because they came out of the beehive. Ah. All right, so let's start with the most familiar thing we've got going here, which is kimchi, which I make sometimes. I haven't made it in a while. This is actually some very good store-bought kimchi. Take a big old chunk there. And I'm going to ask you to think about if you can taste any common elements among these three items. That is, we're looking for the taste of fermentation. Is there such a thing?
Mm. Wow, that's good kimchi.
Mm-hmm.
Kimchi is a very new thing in my repertoire. There's been a more and more Korean food places opening up, and I didn't know that was one of the main condiments in Korean cuisine, and it really just brings so much flavors into those dishes.
Yeah, there are more than 250 kinds of kimchi made in Korea.
Wow.
It depends very much on the region, north and south, like what is produced where and what is the practice. So kimchi is made with what we call Napa cabbage, mm-hmm. sort of standard-ish version, but there's all sorts of different additions. And some kimchis are very spicy. Some of them are fishy. Some of them are, depends. It's like the universal food that is not universal.
Yeah. Then this one is particularly crunchy and there's a nice bite with the peppers.
Yeah.
It's really, really pleasant and interesting to eat.
It's kind of piquant and salty and sour.
And sour a little bit, yeah.
Like, this is a question that some people ask. Is there a taste of fermentation?
Ooh.
Keep that in your brain and in your mouth. We're going to try some miso.
What is miso and how is it made?
So miso, which you know we have always in the house because I like eating it on toast with almond butter. Miso is soybeans that have been fermented using koji, which is Aspergillus oryzae mold. And the koji is sort of like the sourdough starter that you then add to the soybean mash. And then the soybeans ferment under the influence of the aspergillus. And it can take just a few weeks, but then often it's aged or sometimes it's fermented over a very long period very slowly to develop different flavors. It depends. Again, there's a zillion different kinds of miso. This is a white miso.
This is so good.
The salt content is a bit lower, so it tastes a bit sweeter.
But that's the thing. It's a perfect combination of sweet and salty.
And sometimes we mix it with butter. Miso and butter on pasta is wonderful. Miso and butter on a spoon is wonderful.
Well, you know my stance about butter.
So. Yeah, well, miso, we're not going to put it on toast, don't worry.
No, exactly.
Let's go on to the third taste, which is this bee bread or parga. And they're these little pellets.
Take do we...
I have no idea what you do
with bite them. Into them?
You stick it in your mouth, Maxine. Oh, it's soft.
Oh, yeah.
Mmm. What do you get?
I get like a very dark honey.
Yeah. It's sort of, what's the texture to you?
The texture is a little earthy.
I understand why they call it bread. It has a slightly bready but kind of granular bread.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fruity to me. It's like,
yeah, it's a little fruity and there's a tiny bit of sweetness, mm-hmm. like, but it comes much, much later. You recognize honey properties,
yeah,
but you're not quite sure what you're actually eating. At first, I even thought dark chocolate.
Mm, yeah. When they're really cute because they are hexagonal in shape. To me, it's kind of like date jam, but with some acid added.
But is this product supposed to be eaten on its own? Or is it supposed to be added to other things?
I think people basically eat it as a nutritional supplement.
Ah.
It's a cute little snack, too. They're really... Okay, so we have kimchi, acidic, spicy, and a little bit salty. We've got the miso, which is sort of sweet and salty.
Mm-hmm.
And this bee bread, perga, which is sort of sweet and acidic. All of them are fermented.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any unifying taste that you can identify?
Nope. They're all different to me. They all have very different and distinct tastes, even though they're using the same process.
Yeah, well, they're in fact quite different processes because they're they're different microorganisms. There are these different reactions that take place. Some of them are bacterial, some of them are yeast, some of them are enzymatic. Like for example, koji versus lactobacteria that are on our hands when we make kimchi. So different ways that the fermenting agents get into the fermentable foods. So that's maybe good reason that it should taste different.
Yes, it is quite different.
One of the challenges, as we've always talked about, is with taste, the vocabulary that we have to describe the way things taste is not as developed as some of the rest of our vocabulary in the world. Our visual mm-hmm. vocabulary is much stronger than our gustatory vocabulary. So we don't always have the words to put what's happening in our bodies into language.
Well, I've learned so much about fermentation and these different types of products.
Thank you. I'm so glad. Now that we have bee bread and miso and butter. Maybe you can put some miso butter in your bee bread.
I'd rather not.
Okay. Check you next time.
Goodbye.
The French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss was a leading figure in 20th century theories of structural anthropology, including the concept of kinship, that is, how people structure and organize familial ties and relationships and different family practices. In food circles, he's known for having developed a concept known as the culinary triangle, basically an interpretation tool for understanding the values that a society or culture holds by looking at the ways in which they prepare their food. The three points of the triangle are tagged with the words cooked, raw, and rotten, three states of food that speak to the extent to which a food is transformed, as well as the forces that transform it. So cooked food is transformed by humans. Rotten food is transformed by nature, and raw food is untransformed. The triangle actually includes a lot of other elements and details, but I won't go into those here. Instead, take a look in the show notes for a link to the Wikipedia page and a bunch of other resources that describe how the triangle can be used. What's always fascinated me about Lévi-Strauss's triangle is the absence of fermentation as one of the transformational processes. In fact, at one point in my teaching career, I was sort of frustrated, so I redrew the diagram for my students as a kind of thought experiment. And so I added fermentation to the geometry, effectively turning the two-dimensional triangle into a three-dimensional tetrahedron. For me, fermentation absolutely belonged there, as a transformation process that's neither 100% human-driven nor 100% nature-driven. It's actually not driven at all, but is instead a collaboration among many bodies, some human and microbial, some of them the bodies of food things, and then also water and salt and containers and temperatures. So it's kind of a multi-actor relationship or performance even. And in that way, it kind of defies the strict binaries of human or non-human, living or dead, raw or rotten. And so it's in this sense that I think of fermentation as a queering of food. The verb queer initially meant to twist or to alter something, to change it from its normal or normative state into another state of being, one that still kind of looks like the original but just isn't. Of course, in more contemporary parlance, queer tends to refer to sexualities and gender identities, ones that don't conform to normative standards and that exist in more than one state of being, that are non-binary, and that are complex. I kind of see fermented foods as a representation of queerness, or multiplicity, maybe. In theorizing fermentation that way, as well as practicing it in many, many ways, I think there's an opportunity to get some new and interesting ideas about the many ways that people and plants and animals and bacteria and viruses and food, for that matter, can all be understood maybe differently, maybe as in transition, as perpetually becoming or transitioning into something else. And maybe that's the so-called taste of fermentation that I was wondering about with Maxim. Maybe it's there and maybe it isn't. Or maybe we just need some more time and patience and attention to sort out first how to taste fermentation in the first place, and then how to describe it in non-normative terms. Adding a final non-conforming, savory, acidic, and salty note to this episode of Making a Meal of It is this week's respondent to the food questionnaire. When I found out he had agreed to participate in the podcast, the 56-year-old fanboy in me gave out a little gay gasp. His films spoke volumes to me in my young adulthood with their transgression and their sexuality and their overall non-normative attitudes. And while I have never quite reached his level of boldness in my own life, I know that I am a little braver and a little more twisted because of what he created. Bruce LaBruce is a filmmaker, photographer, writer, and artist based in Toronto and working internationally. He has written and directed 14 feature films, including Gerontophilia, which won the Grand Prix at the Festival du Nouveau Cinéma in Montreal in 2013, and Pierrot Lunaire, which won a Teddy Award at the Berlinale in 2014. In 2020, his Quebec-shot film Saint Narcisse was released to very high praise, and for podcast listeners who appreciate the wit and honesty of my stick-this-in-your-mouth partner, Maxime, you may be interested to know that he was the casting director who worked on Saint Narcisse, and hence the connection to Bruce. When Bruce and I recorded his answers to the questionnaire, he described himself as gorgeous, scrumptious, and hardworking. Bruce, of what food or food context are you afraid or distrustful?
Eating live animals.
What word or concept describes a well-balanced food system?
Variety.
What word or concept describes why food systems often remain unbalanced?
Poverty.
Which food person do you most admire?
The galloping gourmet.
Which food innovation do you try to ignore?
Nouvelle cuisine.
What is your greatest gastronomic extravagance?
Smoked mussels.
For what do you hunger?
Chicken livers.
What do you consider to be an overrated food or food context?
Pineapple on pizza.
On what occasion do you feign satiety?
When the cook fucks up.
What do you most dislike about dinner tables?
The one leg that is always uneven.
What is the quality you most like in a fruit?
Freshness.
What is the quality you most like in a cut of meat?
Tenderness.
Which condiments do you most overuse?
Mayonnaise.
What kinds of gardens make you happiest?
Mixed vegetable, corn, and pumpkin patch.
Which culinary skill would you most like to have?
To be able to cook.
If you could change one thing about nutrition, what would it be?
The reduction of sugar and sodium in fast food.
What do you consider your greatest edible achievement?
My pan-blackened, flour-coated chicken livers.
If you were to die and come back as an edible animal, vegetable, or mineral, what would you like it to be?
A puffer fish.
Where and or when would you most like to dine?
Poppy's Fish and Chips in London.
What is your most treasured kitchen implement?
My Jamie Oliver stainless steel nonstick frying pan.
What is your favorite highly processed food?
McDonald's McPlant Nuggets.
What is your favorite aroma?
Fried mushrooms.
What spice, kitchen implement, or cookbook do you use most rarely?
My mortar and pestle.
What do you most value in your friend's food?
International cuisine.
Who are your favorite food writers?
Rebecca Pepler, A.A. Gill.
Who are your favorite food celebrities?
Anthony Bourdain, the soup Nazi.
With which cuisine do you most identify?
Toronto fusion cuisine.
What is your most powerful sense?
Humor.
What are your favorite agricultural, culinary, or gastronomic words?
Flambé, jacquarding, bisque, gazpacho police.
What would you eat as your second-to-last meal?
A British fry-up.
What food-related epitaph would you put on your own tombstone?
He always cleaned his plate.
And what question would you either add to this questionnaire or like to ask me?
What is your favorite extreme cuisine? What is the food that made you barf as a child?
And that closes the lid on this fermentation episode of Making a Meal of It. Thank you to the zymological Josh Evans, the microbial Maya Hay, the enzymatic Bruce LaBruce, and my bubbling bacterial buddy, Maxime Giraud. To the trillions of tiny little beings who live on, in, and around me, I offer my undying gratitude, literally, for their protection and digestion services, as well as their continued company and collaboration. And as usual, a shout out to Ben and Nick at Story Mode, who designed the podcast's music and stings after I told them I wanted something that sounded a little fermented. Check out the show notes for links to various fermentation resources and references, and don't forget to rate and review so that others can find us and share in the conversation. Next week's episode is about satisfying your sweet tooth, or possibly about turning you off desserts forever, with a complex history involving colonialism, slavery, malnutrition, and lots of profitability. Sugar is one of those bittersweet foods that has both divided and conquered nations. In the meantime, as so many have said before, apne bojan kanan led, and ke aprofiti.